You're listening to KSKQ 89.5 FM in Ashland, Oregon, and 94.1 FM in Medford, Oregon. Any views or opinions expressed are solely those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKQ. It's KSKQ's mission to produce community radio that empowers the residents of the Rogue Valley, builds sustainable and resilient communities through the exchange of ideas, and celebrates cultural diversity. And now, let's make it green. Welcome to Tasty Topics and Tantalizing Tunes, where the focus is on health and well-being and other fun stuff. I'm Aletha Nowitzki, and we just heard this show's theme song, Make It Green, composed and performed by me, with musical friends Sandy Metcalf on drums, Rob Lowry on recorder, and Jim Abdo on bass. We are so blessed to have friends and family to share our lives with, helping us accomplish our goals, joining us in celebration of the good times, and encouraging us to keep on keeping on, even through the most challenging times. And when we're just about ready to shuffle off this mortal coil, as Shakespeare so poetically puts it, it's our family and friends who we count on to escort us to the very threshold of the most mysterious passage of all, that of death. It's both a loving and a daunting task, to be sure, and there is so much to do beyond what one might think, especially if called upon to be a prime caregiver for a loved one. Today, we'll hear all about this profound experience from my guest, author Yana Beacham, who has co-written a book called Living with Dying, a most helpful guide that outlines step by step an abundance of information about the physical, spiritual, and emotional journey that lies ahead for anyone who would like to give the best end of life care possible. While I get Yana set up with the mic, let's listen to some music to put us in a receptive state of mind for the information to come. The phenomenon of death has inspired the writing of some of the most beautiful music ever, including one of my own favorite classical pieces. Composed by Maurice Ravel and performed by award-winning Canadian pianist André Laplante, this lovely work is called Pavane for a Dead Princess.
Thank you.
What a beautiful piece of music. Pavane for a Dead Princess, composed by Maurice Ravel with an exquisite performance by pianist André Laplante. And speaking of death, dear listeners, how can we help a loved one have the best death possible? And how can we provide the best end-of-life care and take care of ourselves at the same time? These questions and more are explored in the book Living with Dying, A Complete Guide for Caregivers, written by my guest, Yana Beecham, along with her co-writer, Katie Ortlip. Welcome, Yana. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me, Aletha. It's great to be here.
Yay. Well, tell us a bit about yourself and how you came to be living in the Rogue Valley.
I've been a writer for more than 30 years. And before that, I was an actress and actually continued acting over those 30 years and directing and writing plays. But so I originally started in the Valley in 1977 when I joined the Oregon Shakespeare Festival as an acting member
of
the company.
A fellow Shakespeare Festival employee.
Go Shakespeare. I met my husband here. He was also an actor in the company. He's Malcolm Hillgartner. And we continue to act around the country. And at the same time, I started writing young adult fiction and juvenile fiction.
Nice.
And then Malcolm joined me in the writing process, which was great. And we wrote under the name Yana and Malcolm. So we wrote about 130 books for young adults and juveniles for Scholastic and HarperCollins and Random House and Bantam. And so we could live anywhere. That was the great part of it.
Yeah.
So we were living in Montana, and we had children. This is the long story to get to how I got to the Valley.
That's okay.
We were living in Montana, and we got this call from Trilobite, which was a computer game company here. And they were looking for a writer for their game, Clandestiny. So Malcolm and I flew out to interview for it, and we went, wow, I love this town. I forgot how much we love this town. Plus, we had lots of friends still acting in the company. And now we had children. And in Montana, we'd be driving around looking for a kid. There's one. Get out of the car. Go play with him. So suddenly we're in Lithia Park and we're seeing all these children and families. And we said, let's move here. So we bought a house before we went back, not knowing if we were going to get this job. But and that's how we moved to Ashland.
A lot of faith there.
Yeah, we did get the job, though. That was good.
That is good. And I love that you are a writer of young adult fiction, because that's some of my favorite.
Me too. I go to that
read.
Section all the time. The reason I started writing it was because I loved it so much. That's forever and ever. So
sweet. Well, so you have paired up with your a different writing partner, Katie
yes.
Ortlip, to write the book Living with Dying.
Yes.
So how did you happen to get together with Katie?
Well, Katie is married to actor Michael Hume.
Uh-huh.
And they became our friends. And then they found a house next door to them, suggested we move next door. So we became neighbors and friends. And then we kind of think we're relatives now, cousins. Our children are the same age. But Katie has been a hospice social worker for 25 years. And she, before that, she's also a registered nurse, and not currently practicing as a nurse. So living next door to her, she'd come home from work. And, it was it's a hard job being a hospice social worker, yeah, working with all these people and families who are having to deal with the news that their loved one has a limited amount of time. And the amazing thing about it was that Katie would often come home and say to me, today was a really good death. And so all of us who have a fear of death, I think everyone has a fear of death.
To some extent or another.
I want a really good death.
Yeah.
So I would pump Katie for all the details. And she would explain to me that that most people really, what they really want is to die at home in their bed, surrounded by loved ones, just close their eyes and never wake up. Mm-hmm. And she started telling me that there are really ways that you can make that happen. And I asked her, is there a guidebook for people? Is this written down anywhere, as she talked to me about it? And she said, no, but she wished there was, because she said every day in her job, now 25-year job, she has to tell her clients and patients the same information over and over again, too, which makes them less afraid and actually makes them more informed and makes it be a better death. So she said, I wish there was a guidebook, sort of a death for dummies. And I said, let's write it. I'm a writer. You've got the information. Let's do it. And we started tossing that idea around. And then my father, who had prostate cancer, he was 90, and it metastasized to his bones, and she became his hospice social worker.
Oh.
And so that's when the book really began. We just essentially, she talked me through his last 6 months. I chronicled my caregiving experience, and we wrote the book.
Very good. So, and it's called Living with Dying, A Complete Guide for Caregivers.
Right.
That's beautiful. And I notice it's arranged in a really pretty easy to follow guide. Within the middle, there's a section.
The Caregiver's Manual.
The Caregiver's Manual.
Yeah. The book is broken down into chapters, basically sort of starting with when you get the news and everyone's in free fall and doesn't know what to do. But the center part of it is truly just an easy-to-use manual. So something's wrong. Somebody has a nosebleed. Your patient has a nosebleed. They can't breathe. They're having stomach cramps or whatever, diarrhea, or you know, all those things. And the guide basically lists symptoms and what you as a caregiver can do, and what we also list what doctors and would do. A medical professional might prescribe, so that you have all the information. And so it's bold, the bold type, boxed, easy to read, because no one who's a caregiver has the time to sit down and read a really dense book that you can't flip to what you need the information for. So we started with that when we started writing the book.
Very good. And you've bookended that with other material.
Right,
which
right.
Which is wonderful. How to care for the caregiver,
right?
As yourself. Talk a little bit about that,
okay.
If you would.
That's the part I bring to this story. I bring the frantic, overwhelmed, underinformed part of suddenly being a caregiver when you're not really cut out to be a caregiver.
Right.
And I bring that to the story. And what happens is we all get thrust into it, and sooner or later we're either going to be a caregiver or we're going to be taken care of.
That's right.
Especially right now, with people are turning 65, 10,000 people every day. So we're either taking care of our parents or someone will be taking care of us. So I was really kind of a lunatic. As soon as my dad got sick, I was frantic. You know, I thought, okay, I'm going to solve this. I'm going to make sure he's not in pain. I'm going to, I'll set up all the doctors. I'll run back and forth. I'll make sure he gets the right food. And I was driving back and forth to my parents' house, frantically ordering them around and getting him to the doctors. And he was in horrible pain. And so I really needed this book. I needed a book to tell me how to calm down, how to take care of myself, what's necessary and really what isn't necessary. Mm-hmm. Once I determined what my parents really needed was somebody to drive them to a hairdresser appointment or a doctor's appointment, someone to just be there. That's really it. And instead, I was thinking I had to do all this stuff.
Right. And it sounds to me like even the best way to give the best care is to care for yourself.
That's it. And it's right now I'm my 93-year-old mother's living with me, and I have to kind of keep referring back to what the advice we give for caregivers, because it really is all about just sitting and listening. I think it's mostly about really taking a deep breath, which seems kind of simple, but Katie and I met with the hospice house, one of the board, a board committee that's developing hospice house in Medford. Mm-hmm. And they were talking about, that's the advice they give to the volunteers. It's about when you spend time with the patient, you sit down, you don't stand, standing looks like you don't have time. I'm just going to be here for about 30 seconds and see if you're okay, and then I'm leaving. And Katie really has that. I watch her with my mother and my father before that and other patients. And she comes into a room. She sits down. She moves her chair right up to the person. Generally, they're older, so they have difficulty hearing. And she sometimes she sits on their walker. And if the walk, if there isn't a chair in the room, Katie will, and they're in a bed, she'll kneel beside the bed. She just shows them that she has time to listen. And it's all about listening. That's the lesson I learned. People want to talk. And as a caregiver, if you just take a deep breath and listen, instead of having to feel like you have to come up with solutions for whatever they're telling you, mm-hmm. that has been the greatest lessons I learned from working with Katie. She's kind of, it's more of a calling for her than a job.
Oh.
Yeah, she's kind of, and she's a, I call her my Sherpa. She's guided me through my dad's death, and I want her to take me to the light when the time comes.
There you go. You know, that's wonderful. I have a former boyfriend who is possibly going that direction of crossing over, and so I've been visiting him. And that's what he wants most is just to sit there. I sit next to him. We hold hands. He just talks to me, and I, you know, chime in if I have something to say. But mostly he just wants to talk and know someone's there who cares about him.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And yeah. The fact that you're holding hands with him really is also another part. Be mm-hmm. sure that you touch your patient. I try to tell myself to make sure I hug my mom at least every day, even though she can be the crankiest old lady on the planet.
Oh, can't I?
Yeah, and I respond in kind.
That's wonderful. Well, let's have a little song break. This song is composed by Frederick Clark, who's a wonderful, masterful guitarist. And the song is called Soaring Eagle. And you can just let your heart soar and think about your loved ones and so we'll take a little break. This is from his Images from the Skies Woven by Strings. So let's listen to Soaring Eagle.
Thank you.
Soaring Eagle, composed and performed by guitarist Frederick Clark. And I'm here with Yana Beecham, who is one of the authors of Living with Dying, a complete guide for caregivers. And we're going to talk about hospice now, which is, there's a chapter about that in the book. And it's so valuable for so many reasons. And Yana, why don't you expound on that?
All right, I will. So in our previous discussion, I was talking about how frantic I was. I was just running around trying to solve all of my parents' problems, find the cure for cancer, and manage my own house and my own kids and my family and my work. When my father was diagnosed with that his bone cancer had, that his prostate cancer had metastasized to his bones, he had about 6 months guess that he had left, and his doctor suggested he go on hospice, and that's where Katie came in.
Right.
Katie as the hospice social worker, and Katie, you know, we all have these ideas about hospice. We think they're, you know, hospice is, you go on hospice for the last 24 hours of your life and they give you some shot that knocks you out forever. Or you go to some place. These are all myths about hospice. And really what I discovered was hospice is, it's kind of the support team. So, especially for caregivers, the hospice comes in and suddenly, within 24 hours, we had all the equipment we'd ever need. Katie ordered it up. He needed a hospital bed. He needed a bedside commode. He needed a shower chair. They help you. They just help you make all these decisions that you didn't have any information to make them with. You know, you're just trying to Google things and research. What do I need to do now? And so once Katie came in, and then a hospice nurse gets assigned to you. And essentially, the discussion is not about death. It's really about how do you want to live the rest of your life?
Yeah.
What do you want to do each day? How does each really great day look to you? And so it became this really uplifting group that arrived. We had, you know, the nurse, she became our best friend. Chris Earle was my father's nurse, and she came, and he was so happy to see her all the time. They just become part of your family. And there's all sorts of support they can offer. There's massage therapists. There's music therapists if you want to have someone play, there are volunteers who come and play. If you want to have a choir come sing at your side, they help you decide, you know, what's a good, where do you want to spend your last, you know, months, days, weeks, and set up a good environment for it. Mm-hmm. So most people, like I said in the beginning, want to die at home. But I think the statistics are 80% of the people, when asked whether they'd like prefer to die in a hospital or at home, they choose at home. Only 20% of the people die at home because they just let things happen. They don't make any choices that can make it happen that you can be at home.
Uh-huh.
So having hospice come in, not for your last minute, but the last 6 months, is a really good idea. In fact, Katie says that most people who have hospice wish they'd gone on it sooner. It's not, you have to have a prognosis of 6 months, but it's just that you're not seeking curative help. You're not going to go through chemotherapy anymore.
Right.
You're not going to, but if you break a leg, of course you can go have your leg, you know, set. It's not that kind of thing.
Right.
But they also help with comfort, making you comfortable. So that's where the myth about, you know, morphine and pain medications come in. They get knocked out. But really, when hospice arrived at the team came to my door and saved me, my dad had been given these meds to supposedly help with pain, but in reality, they just made him kind of a loony tune. He was hallucinating. He was dingy. He kept trying to leave the house through the fireplace.
Oh my!
But he was still in pain. So I was taking him before hospice. I was taking him to have X-rays and MRIs, and it hurt so much for him to get on the table. And it was funny because Katie said to me, she goes, "You know, not all the medications he's on don't always help with pain. His pain might be something you can, since it's bone pain, why don't you try giving him 4 Advil every 4 hours? And that was sort of the miracle cure.
Oh my God.
So it's not like you're getting loaded up with medications. In fact, you're just having someone, a team of people, really focus on you and making you happy and making your family happy. So I can't say enough good things about hospice. So if someone is given a prognosis, you also don't have to, you can go off hospice if you suddenly get better. Because Katie said a lot of times people get better once they stop all those medications they were taking, they suddenly start improving, and you can go off hospice, and you also can come back on again, and you know, if it comes, whatever you needed again. So
just proves that all that positive attention and such really does help, makes you even want to live, perhaps.
It does, yeah. My dad looked forward to everybody's visits. They had fun. We found a caregiver that was just right for him, who played the guitar, and they sang all the time. You know, it was just, dad's last 6 months were great. They were great. And finally, for me, it was great. I knew there were people that were holding us, you know, big arms around my mom, me, and my dad. So,
right.
Yeah.
And all this ties into having that good death. You know, what is a good death? And how can we keep our hearts open while our loved one is dying? You know, I always think about that. You know, not to get so overwhelmed.
Oh, with the grief of it. Yeah, sometimes, I forgot. I have to look at my book, but there's a caregiver. There's
allowed.
A grief that happens that as soon as you find out the bad news, a caregiver can start grieving already. I mean, before. And it's sometimes it has to do with not being able to talk about it. Katie was saying that oftentimes patients really want to talk about it, but their loved ones don't. My sister-in-law would not discuss anything with my brother-in-law who died of cancer. She wouldn't talk. She refused to talk about hospice. She refused to talk about, you know, how he wanted to live out his days. She refused to accept that he had a limited time on this planet. And so he had what I would describe a not good death. He ended up in the hospital on a ventilator, and he shouldn't have been on one. He had lung cancer. I mean, it was a horrible thing because they wouldn't talk about it. So, and that's what's in the caregiver business called having the conversation.
Yes. What all is involved in that conversation, would you say?
So this is the first step in how do you find ways to make sure, you know, there are random things you can't control, but how do you try to have the best finish of your life? So you start with having the conversation. And having the conversation is asking yourself or your loved one or all of you. We got a form called the Advanced Directive, and Oregon has one. They have other ones around the country. They have different names. I think the most states use a document called the 5 Wishes document. And you fill it out and you say, what kind of, when you know that you're coming to your end, what kind of extreme treatments do you want? Do you want a ventilator? Do you want to be put on a feeding tube? Do you need hydration or oxygen? Do you want to go to everything extreme to keep yourself, or your heart still beating, I guess? And talking to Katie, this is where I discovered that those extreme treatments are actually, can be, not always, but can be actually detrimental. So if you start, because the body actually does know how to die itself.
Mm-hmm. I thought that was really fascinating what I learned about in the book. Tell us about
that. It's really interesting. And this is really comforting to know that there is a system.
It is.
Not like a random accident's going to happen. Horrible things are going to happen to you.
Uh-huh.
It's the body, as you sort of head to the end, your body starts to shut down. So your digestive system's not working as well, which makes people not want to eat. Mm-hmm. They usually start by not wanting to eat meat. And this is where caregivers go sideways. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, my mom would report to me, I got him to eat. you know, roast beef and a bowl of soup and a side of mashed potatoes and a, you know, well, that's not always helpful. In fact, if someone says they don't want to eat, don't force food on them. Ask them what sounds good to them, because if your digestive system is not working anymore. So when you start forcing things into a machine that's not working, things go wrong. It's more painful.
Right.
Same thing with hydration. Artificial hydration, you know, it's required for some people, but it's also not helpful towards the end. Sometimes it can fill up where your body can't process all this water, and it starts filling the cavities, and that's painful, and mm-hmm. that's not helping. In fact, as the body dies, you start not wanting to eat, start not wanting to drink, and as the system starts shutting down, and kidney failure happens. The body releases these endorphins, sort of the high of the end, and it makes it not be painful, and then you start to get sleepy, really sleepy, and you spend your last days maybe, you know, barely waking up as your body's doing the final process of, you know, ending. Mm-hmm. And when my father was dying, Katie talked me through this, so it was really interesting and really helpful, and it made me not afraid. In fact, in his last hours when he was actively dying, he'd already stopped eating. He'd stopped drinking, but we would use these. They're called toothettes, and they're little sponges on sticks, and they're mint-flavored. And they're kind of, Katie would come in and show me, just brush his teeth, you know, rub it on his tongue. And you know, he was already really kind of not waking up, but... in a half sleep, I guess. Mm-hmm. And it was refreshing, and it kept his mouth moisturized, and we put chapstick on his lips. So nothing is painful. I mean, you know, it's all comfort care. And then she started pointing out to me, see what's happening to the body? Look what it's doing. And she was my father is there, and she was going, good job, Charlie. Good job. And we all stood around like, wow, we're doing a good job. We're all working on this together. And as the body, the blood starts not being able to circulate as well. So that's why you get cold feet and cold hands and all that. And the blood starts going to the organs, the major organs. Right. So you start getting a rash around your chest or around in the back, oftentimes, so where the kidneys are. And those. So we watch. She would point it out as we got close to the finish. And mm-hmm. And sometimes you can have a fever, and then the breathing changes. There's all sorts of, and this is pretty consistent. Everyone's death is unique, but these are pretty consistent things that happen to the body. And he followed that to the end. And then when he died, Katie and I were out of the room, but suddenly we heard like a static over the baby monitor that I had in there. And she goes, he's gone. That was him leaving. And
oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
I know. And it was funny. She told me, she said, you know, if you're good, she also told me that if, you know, don't be upset if you're not in the room when your parent goes, because quite often parents can't leave until you leave. So I know so many people who've told me, I was with my mom for night and day, and then I got up to get a drink of water from the water fountain, and she died while I was gone. And mm-hmm. and Katie said, especially with moms, most often moms will not die with their children in the room.
Oh my gosh, isn't that interesting?
Yeah. But all that information makes you go, oh, there yeah. is a reason there, you know, and it made me not afraid. And actually working with hospice made my dad not afraid. And so he had a good death.
He had a good death. So listen to the body and what it wants to do if you are on your, you know, last breath practically.
Yeah.
And caregivers, you know, to respect that, you know.
Yeah.
When death speaks, listen.
Right.
And I have a beautiful song here called Death Speaks, composed by David Lang, who was the winner of the 2008 Pulitzer Prize for Music. And this is from his album, Death Speaks. So just a beautiful piece to contemplate death and the strange beauty.
Yeah.
And the strange mystery that it entails. So. Death Speaks by David Lang, a beautiful meditation on death. And I'm here with Yana Beacham, and we're speaking about her book that she wrote along with Katie Ortlip called Living with Dying, A Complete Guide for Caregivers. And we're talking a lot about hospice. And fortunately, hospice is covered by Medicare.
Yes, it is. So, And Medicaid.
All right.
You know, another thing that people don't really understand, this was big news to me. Medicare doesn't cover caregivers, hiring a caregiver.
Yeah.
And we all are going to a nursing home.
Mm-hmm.
Medicaid does. That means you have to have certain, you have to really be without money to be able to apply for Medicaid. I mean, have a certain income level that's a low income level.
Okay.
To apply for Medicaid, and then you can get into a nursing home or all of that. I know, because that's part of the discussion right now in our universe, in our country.
Right.
So people, it's good for people to know that Medicaid, which is the can be on the chopping block in these discussions, is what's paying for many seniors to be taken care of in nursing homes. It's not Medicare. Medicare will not do that.
Okay. So let's keep both of those things.
Medicare does pay for, like, if you were in the hospital and then you got home and you needed some, you know, care, limited amount of care for the next couple of weeks, or you need to go right to a nursing home to repair from the, I mean, to heal from the hospital. That's covered, but not long-term care, I guess I should say.
Okay. Got it.
But hospice is.
Yes.
And there will always, and hospice will always find a way to help people be able to afford it. And that's part of the social worker help finding you help too.
I love that hospice is covered by both of those.
Yes, yeah. Me too.
Yeah. And so then they can help you with all kinds of things, as can this book.
Yeah.
Would you tell us how we can get a hold of this book, should we so desire to do so?
Yes. Well, locally, Bloomsbury is carrying it.
Oh, that's good.
And it is also available at the Hospice Boutique in Ashland.
Oh, I love that place.
As they call it. Yeah. They've just asked for 50 more copies. They had already had 20, so we're excited. I'm hoping people have this guide. It's a guide that I keep referring to, and I'm taking care of my mom, and I've sent, you know, chapters to friends who are dealing with things, and it's not always just dying. It's what's happening in your life, or if you're just a caregiver being burnt out, and things you can do to help yourself.
I found it very helpful just reading through, very much.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. I should say, though, that we're talking about this book that I've written with Katie, and Katie was unable to come this morning, the book is I'm the writer, and she is the information person, and it's great because it also chronicles our experience together and what I've learned. And so she's around in the valley. She's known to people in the hospice world as Katie O.
Katie O. Well, it's a beautiful book. And I even noticed that the cover seems to be somewhat water resistant.
Yeah.
Which is probably a good idea considering.
Yes.
That's lovely. You can just take it wherever and spill things on it.
Yeah. Coffee stains.
Not going to matter.
Wine.
So this is beautiful. Take care of yourself. Be with your loved one. You know, just to recap, and the book is a wonderful resource for all the practical stuff from toileting to feeding.
Changing a diaper, moving a person in bed.
Yeah, that's a trick there.
Actually, we had friends who've bought it for the caregivers they've hired for their parents, because oftentimes people have discovered, not always, but that caregivers that they aren't always trained, especially trained for someone who's bedridden and stuff. So,
Yeah. Well, is there any last words of advice or encouragement, anything you would most like our listeners to take away from this talk today?
Yes. So I bring the caregiver element to this book. So here are the lessons I've been learning.
Okay.
So I've learned to sit down. That I've mentioned that before.
Right.
Sit down and take a deep breath and listen, and keep on listening. That's a lesson when you're dealing with someone who's ill. But for yourself, sit down, take a deep breath. Sometimes just closing your eyes for 20 seconds is like a miniature nap. So I would do this breathing exercise when I was driving over to my parents or getting ready to go in to visit. And I would do a breathing exercise before I went in. And recently Katie and I participated in a seminar where a woman from Joyful Yoga mentioned that, and I've been using this tip, sometimes the small ones, breathe in through your right nostril and it energizes you. She said, breathe in through your right nostril. And when you want to go to sleep at night, to breathe in through your left nostril, take deep breaths through your left nostril. It kind of calms you down, which I don't know the mechanics behind that, but it's a simple thing that I've, in the course of a day, when I'm kind of feeling a little burnt out, I'll do the right nostril breathe.
Well, that's interesting because it follows along with the right brain, left brain thing.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like breathing in through your left nostril would relax you more. You're using your right side of your brain, which is the more creative, artistic part. So I can see that. That's very interesting.
So that's what be kind and forgive yourself. I, every day I would get up and feel guilty about some rotten thing I'd said to my, snapped at my mother or whatever. Oh. And you just have to keep telling yourself you're doing the best you can with the knowledge you have and the tools you have.
And, right. And that, dear listeners, is when this show's recording ended. Thanks so much to Yana Beecham for coming in and speaking about her and her co-writer Katie Ortlip's book, Living with Dying, A Complete Guide for Caregivers, which is available at Bloomsbury Books in Ashland, Oregon, Hospice Unique Boutique, also in Ashland, and online at Amazon.com. More information about the book and its authors can be found at the website livingwithdying.com. Let's close with a beautiful piece composed by my daughter Vanessa Nowitzki and sung by Vanessa and some of her many musical friends. It's a setting of Khalil Gibran's poem On Love, because after all, in the end, love is what it's really all about. Have a wonderful day, dear listeners.
When love beckons to you, follow him.
Oh, for another.